You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
William Bratton was the commissioner of New York City Police from 1994 to 1996 during the first years of the Giuliani administration. And now he's returned to our city after serving 7 years as chief of police in Los Angeles and several years in business. I'm very pleased to welcome Commissioner Bill Bratton back to our show. Hi, good to see you.
Good morning. It's great to be back. Actually, good afternoon.
Yeah, we just passed noon. You're back as New York City Police Commissioner after 18 years. What are the biggest challenges you see in the city or in policing it? Is it very different than it was 18 years ago?
It is very different, which for me is fortunate. It's not deja vu all over again. One, the city is incredibly safe compared to the circumstances we were dealing with back in 1994 or earlier in 1990 when I was chief of the transit police. Secondly, the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism is something that consumes a lot of my time and a lot of the resources of the police department now. Back in 94, 95, after the first World Trade Center bombing, we thought we had solved it, resolved it. And quite clearly, we had not. So a third issue is technology, the technology of today. We did not have cell phones and everything that's so commonplace today back then. So it's a very new experience for me.
Well, New York City is twice as large as L.A. and over 10 times as large as the city where you got your start, Boston. How does sheer size affect the task of policing New York City?
Each city is very different. It's like a doctor looking at a patient. We're all human beings, and there's an effort oftentimes made to compare cities. You really cannot. And myself having now police Boston, L.A., and New York, they are very different patients with very different issues, health issues, if you will. L.A. had tremendous gang problems, and I'm talking mega gangs.
Still does.
Still does, although it's down dramatically from what it was. Chicago's experiencing much more gang-related violence than L.A. In New York, we have these small neighborhood crews, as they're called here, 15, 20, 25 kids, usually from a housing development or a couple of square blocks. Oftentimes, unlike the major gangs in Chicago and L.A., who are basically fighting over narcotics, fighting over human trafficking issues, or basically significant criminals, here that a lot of it sometimes is they're just fighting over foolishness, respect issues, and you looked at me the wrong way, that you insulted my girlfriend, stupid things that they kill each other over. So it's a very different type of crime issues to deal with.
And New York has 1 million more people now than it did the last time you were police commissioner. I don't know if that matters at all.
It actually does, because it's a sign of how the vitality of this city. Back in 94, we had 25 million tourists, and we were losing tourists. Now we have 56 million, and we're gaining. Population's increased. Back in 1990, when I first arrived at the transit police, they had about 3 million subway riders a day. Now it's 5.5 million rides a day. Good news is, just the reports we released this week, on an average day, we have about 6 reported crimes on the subway, serious crime, in a system that has 5.5 million riders. Phenomenal.
How does that compare to other large subway systems in the world?
Subway systems, by and large, in most cities tend to be safe, but they certainly were not in New York. They were not perceived to be that way in the 90s, and now they are.
And we don't have the graffiti we used to have either.
Graffiti is a constant battle, though. It's one of the issues I'm going to be focusing on. I've already spoken to the mayor about my sense that graffiti is growing in the city now again, and as a city, we need to basically take it on, because that's the first sign of urban decay, if you will, graffiti.
Studies indicate that the lowered crime rate in New York wasn't a reflection of a national pattern, but was achieved through the policing approaches you and your successors put into place. Were you able to do something similar in Los Angeles, or did it turn out to be a tougher nut to crack than you imagined?
We were both a part of and not a part of a national trend, because crime did go down nationally in the 90s in response to a renewed focus with the national government, local government.
And demographics.
Demographics play a role in that, the idea that a lot of young people in the population. But in New York, in every instance, our numbers were better than any place else. Similarly, in L.A., during the 7 years I was there, the crime rates in the declines in L.A. were matching those of New York in the 90s. And indeed, today, L.A. is still reducing crime at a faster rate than New York. Good news in New York is that we are a very safe city. We have our pockets of crime, and that's what we're focusing on. Like a doctor, that you make the patient well, then you can focus on those that might make the patient ill again, and that's what we're doing here.
Do different cities have different kinds of crimes? For example, Newark has a high murder rate, but a comparatively low rate of rape.
Each city, again, is different. For example, Newark has a phenomenal problem with carjackings, and we don't have a similar problem here in New York. We also don't have a major problem with gun violence involving weapons such as AK-47s versus Chicago and L.A. have more experience with that type of
weapon. Even though they have gun laws.
We tend to have still some of the best gun laws in America, and certainly former Mayor Bloomberg's focus, and now continue with Mayor de Blasio, as well as at the state level, that benefits us.
Are you surprised that we haven't seen an increase in the crime rate as a result of the economic downturn that's been lingering for the past 6 years?
No, not at all. The two are not linked at all.
They are linked, at least.
No, it's. I think I thought I killed that fable that. In the city of Los Angeles, the economy had a 14% unemployment rate during most of the time I was there. And the economic crimes you look at, shoplifting, theft of copper from abandoned buildings, none of that went up. The economy basically benefits from safer cities, but I don't think if you've got an effective police force, there's a real negative when the economy tanks.
My guest is New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton. The NYPD got a reminder of public opinion last Tuesday when it tried some outreach via Twitter with the hashtag, number?
I think it was
MyNYPD.
MyNYPD.
In hours, Twitter was just flooded with images and accounts of police abuse. Were you watching the Twitter stream as it grew?
We certainly were. We were very appreciative of it that this past weekend I just passed 10 followers on my tweet account. I did not see, despite the headlines that the sky was falling and the NYPD experiment was a massive failure, I saw it as a success. Look at all the people that were attracted to that site, not just the characters that sent in the old news stories, the old photos, photos taken out of context. We reviewed most of those photos that a lot of what was occurring there was lawful police action. It looks awful, but it's legal. I did not see that as a negative at all.
When you were sworn in on January 2nd, you said, I'm quoting, "We will all work hard to identify why it is so many in the city do not feel good about this department." At that time, what evidence had you seen that people don't feel good about the NYPD?
Quite clearly, the election. That the election was fueled largely by the stop, question, and frisk issue. It was fueled by the concern in the Muslim community about surveillance activities directed at that community. It was fueled in many respects by a disaffection for the police department when the results that the department was achieving, historic low crime rates. Last year was a historic low year for crime in the city of New York, but you would not have known that by reading the newspapers.
Well, is stop and frisk the largest factor behind negative opinions about the NYPD?
I think in communities of color, particularly the African-American community, it certainly was. But I think even in other communities that around the city that were reading the same papers, that they felt that something was wrong, and something was wrong.
Well, you have kind of defended it. If you'd like a modified version of it?
I'm an ardent supporter of stop, question, and frisk. It is.
But you say stop, question, and frisk. It's different than stop and frisk.
The more common term is stop and frisk, but it's all about stop, question, and frisk. Sorry, that's the basic tool of American policing. What happened here, it was applied too much, particularly in communities of color. And it was, I think, misunderstood the belief that crime was going down because of the application of hundreds of thousands of stops. Crime has continued to go down this year with hundreds of thousands of fewer stops. And the good news is the stops that are being made, more of them are resulting in summonses and arrests indicating that they are appropriate stops.
Well, after Mayor de Blasio announced his intention to drop Bloomberg's appeal of the federal ruling on stop and frisk, several unions representing the police indicated they might take up the appeal.
That's correct, and I think they have, but the good news is that has not stopped them and their members from very aggressively policing the streets of New York. But doing it in a way where the unions themselves would tell you one of the reasons for the low morale in the department, they felt that they were being pressured to do things that they felt were inappropriate. And they felt that many of the stops that they were being measured for in terms of activity were inappropriate. And that's why you don't see them. While they're appealing it to the courts, you're not seeing a resultant action in the streets, a diminishing, if you will, of effective police work.
Well, when cops do their jobs well, people tend not to notice. things are going as expected. It's only when police behavior seems to be out of line, or at least is perceived as being out of line.
What you've effectively just articulated is the first principle of Sir Robert Peel, the creator of the Metropolitan Police, and his nine principles, which I espouse all the time. And the idea is that the effectiveness of police is measured more by, if you will, the lack of visibility of them enforcing the law, the fact that they have been able to maintain peace without effectively having to resort to use of force.
In contrast to public opinion, how is morale inside the department?
I think right now, this is my personal opinion, but I think if you read the chief lead of the paper that reports on government employees, and if you listen to my various unions, the sense is that morale is on the upswing. There was a general belief that there was low morale, both in the uniformed and the civilian ranks of the department.
And why was that?
Certainly what I heard. That.
And what was the reason for that? Was it just
a
kind of a disconnect between the top and the
multiple factors.
The regular cops?
The uniformed cops quite clearly felt that they were being pushed too hard to generate the numbers, the low crime activity levels. I think there was a general concern, civilian and uniformed members, about the lack of contracts over a number of years. Same thing every city employee is concerned with at this time. There's a lot of reasons for it, but I think at the moment there's a sense of being asked to be included in the reorganization of the department, which we are doing. They are participating in our reengineering efforts. And oftentimes that change in leadership sometimes creates a positive effect that Commissioner Kelly, no denying it, that during his 12 years, he and the mayor did a great job reducing crime in the city, continuing what had begun in the 1990s. We're now continuing it with the new administration. But it's, in some respects, how it was done that was generating both frustration in the department and certainly resentment in the community.
You've talked about the currency that's necessary for establishing successful collaboration.
Well, the currency is really the idea of doing it in a way that, one, in policing, it's lawful, that you don't break the law to enforce it. Two, it's respectful, and that's a very big thing in policing, and certainly in minority communities, the issue of respect. Thirdly, that you do it consistently. You don't police differently in white neighborhoods from poor neighborhoods. And fourthly, that you do it compassionately. You do it in a way that people respond to it positively.
It's often pointed out that drug use is as high or sometimes even higher in some white neighborhoods than it is in minority neighborhoods, and yet you wouldn't know that from the way police act.
I think what ends up happening is that a lot of drug usage, visible drug usage, is much higher in poorer communities, oftentimes minority communities, which oftentimes, unfortunately, are the poorer communities. And that so the whole issue of disparate treatment is something that's being looked at closely nationally and locally as to why do more blacks or Latinos get arrested for this offense than whites.
And wind up in the prisons.
And at the same time, that I think we all clearly understood that the efforts in the 80s and 90s, that too many people went to prison who should not have, and disproportionately among minorities, that the issue of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, crack cocaine offenses generated more incarceration rates, and the population using crack was primarily an African-American population. White population was using powdered cocaine. Offenses were treated differently, and that's clearly known and understood.
You were commissioner during the first 2 years of one of the more conservative administrations in New York City, Rudy Giuliani's, and now you're back with Bill de Blasio, who many expect to be one of the more liberal mayors. Have you already seen significant differences in style at City Hall?
Oh, certainly. I think the mayor, this mayor coming in, as Giuliani before, clearly stated what they were going to do. That, Giuliani talked very much about the focus on crime. This mayor focused clearly on a progressive agenda, some of it relating to crime, and that he was not going to end stop and frisk, but he was going to ensure that it was done in a lawful, constitutional way. And the two mayors have very similar goals, and they have a clear vision of where they wanted to go and very focused on getting there.
Well, that means that as police commissioner, you have to be as aware of the politics as you are of your job of keeping the city safe.
That's correct, and politics is a big part of any police commissioner's life and survivability. I was very successful in achieving my goals back in 94, 95, relative to making the city safer, getting crime down, but was not successful at maintaining the political relationship that would have allowed me to stay in that position. Did a much better job in Los Angeles, and I think so far so good with Mayor de Blasio on staying politically attuned to where he's going.
You may not be willing to say this, but it was the sense of most people that the reason you and Rudy Giuliani didn't get along as well as you should have, considering the success, was because you were getting such positive press.
Well, I think quite certainly we were getting, by and large, positive press, as was he, in the sense of he was the mayor. But I think both of us learned something coming out of that experience in terms of our respective personalities and management styles. And were we to work together again, might it be different? I don't know. It's unlikely that we will work together again. But I learned a lot out of coming out of that experience, and I think it served me well in my previous experience in Los Angeles, and now we are working with Mayor de Blasio.
William Bratton is my guest. He's once again the commissioner of the New York City Police Department, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, film accompanist Ben Modell and film historian Steve Massa discuss a newly restored series of silent slapstick comedies that haven't been publicly available for 97 years. Plus, Swoozy Kurtz looks back at her life and her acting career. And here's a reminder to sign up for our monthly book club e-newsletter. If you do it before April 30th, you'll be registered for a chance to win a subscription to the Paris Review. You can sign up now on our show page. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from Cornell Executive MBA Program, offering weekend classes in Metro NYC for mid-career managers in their retreat-like setting. Event dates, webinars, and more at cornellemba.com. The new musical, Holler If You Hear Me, inspired by the lyrics of Tupac Shakur, at the Palace Theater on Broadway, with Saul Williams, Saigon Sunblow, Chris Jackson, and Tonya Pinkins, and directed by Kenny Leon. Previews start June 2nd, Ticketmaster.com. LV Wood, manufacturers of bespoke wood flooring. Bespoke wood floors are made to order and are all made in the USA. The New York showroom at 24 West 20th Street is open to the public. More at lvwood.com.
Technology is constantly changing our lives and relationships. On WNYC's New Tech City, we're finding out what it all means. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Join me every week for personal stories and expert advice. We'll look at what the apps, data, and nonstop connectivity are really doing to our brains and our values. New Tech City, where hearts and minds meet bits and bytes. Tune in Wednesdays on Morning Edition or get the podcast at wnyc.org/newtechcity.
We're back with New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton, and tonight you're going to be at the 92nd Street Y with two former generals, Stanley McChrystal and Dana Bourne, to discuss leadership in the 21st century. Why would a conference on leadership include a police commissioner and two military leaders, but no business or political leaders?
Well, the event that will be moderated by David Gergen, leadership is necessary in any environment, and policing and the military are oftentimes co-linked, if you will, or linked. And I'm looking forward to the discussion tonight. I've not met the other two, the other two individuals, the generals. But leadership is, and traits of leadership are important in any profession or any career path.
Well, do you see a police department as being run along similar lines to the military? How much dissent?
There's a paramilitary aspect, the sense that the wearing of uniforms, the discipline systems, the authorization to use force, the controlled use of force. So there are parallels, but I've been in the Army and I've been in policing certainly for many years, and there are many differences also that, what the military are called upon to do is very different in many respects than what police are called upon to do.
Well, Dana Bourne was head of the Behavioral Sciences and Leadership Department at the Air Force Academy. How important is behavioral science today in police work or other areas of safety or defense?
Well, I think it's important in any arena, the idea of why do people do what they do. If you want to change behavior, how do you do that? Effectively, if you think of policing, what do police do? The police control behavior, and we attempt to control it in a way that we change it. So in the 1990s, in the subway system, 250,000 people each day not paying the fare, $1.15 theft of service. How do you change that behavior? Well, we use the police to control that behavior by initially making a lot of very public arrests. And with that, we had the added benefit, unanticipated benefit, that one out of every seven people stopped and arrested was wanted on a warrant for a previous offense, and one out of approximately every 20 was carrying some type of weapon in those days. So we had the idea of an appropriate use of police power to control behavior, doing it in a lawful way, doing it in a respectful way, that brought about phenomenal change in behavior in the subways.
And the catchwords those days were zero tolerance and broken windows.
Interestingly enough, zero tolerance is a word that the British government embraced after visiting New York in 1994 when I was police commissioner. Shadow Home Secretary, Mr. Straw, was fascinated by the term zero tolerance, that we only applied to police corruption. We never applied it to anything else we were doing. But the Brits took that back. The Brits took the whole concept of quality of life, broken windows enforcement, and gave it the name zero tolerance. So the way they use the term is different than the way we use the term here.
Well, you've had an interesting relationship with the Brits. In 2009, Queen Elizabeth made you an honorary commander of the most excellent order of the British Empire.
My CBE.
I should have introduced you as Sir William, but
Boston
Irishman to be a CBE?
It's one step below knighthood. If you're not a British citizen, you cannot be knighted. It doesn't get me good tables in London restaurants, though, that I get to put it behind my name when I sign in at places.
A British Prime Minister David Cameron approached you to become the new Metropolitan Police Commissioner in July 2011. But the Home Office blocked that?
A clarification. There was never discussion about that position with the Prime Minister. Prime Minister had indicated he would like to see a change in leadership and open it up to non-British citizens, and it was widely speculated he was referring to me. The law at that time that the Home Secretary referred to did not allow a non-British citizen to take the position. They have since in the process of changing that law.
So you could serve as an advisor to the British government, which
I did for a brief period of time around the issue of gang violence at the time they were having their riots.
My guest is William Bratton, who is New York City Police Commissioner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How much is left up to officers on the street with a zero-tolerance policy? How many decisions end up being judgment calls made on the spot?
The term zero-tolerance, as I indicated, is inappropriate because it implies that they would have no discretion. The best police force is one which has trained its officers to a level where they can exercise the great discretion that they are given to admonish, to summons, to arrest, to use force if appropriate. Police officers in our society, in our democratic form of government, are given great latitude. And it's when you restrict that latitude for a variety of reasons that you sometimes start getting into trouble. And so, for example, stop, question, and frisk was one of those issues where officers were being constantly encouraged to generate numbers, to generate stops, and that that type of zero tolerance, to use the term, where officers were expected to address every infraction in a very significant way, it really led to an overreaction to some of the conditions they were finding.
Well, right now we're seeing changes in attitudes about marijuana use throughout the country. Does that mean that the police will be a little more tolerant if they see somebody smoking pot?
Police have to be respectful of whatever the laws or the ordinances are. Myself, I am not supportive of legalization of marijuana. I'm supportive of medical marijuana use, but that's abused tremendously any place that's been applied. At the same time, in this state, there is a desire, as well as around the country, to lessen the penalties, particularly penalties for possession of or smoking in public. I'm not averse to some of that movement. If there are alternative punishments to basically having an arrest record, that we're working right now with the judges and the district attorney over in Brooklyn on an initiative as an alternative policy to, if you're arrested for some of those offenses, you're going to a court monitored program. You complete it, and then they'll basically erase the arrest.
There have been a number, talking about Brooklyn, there have been a number of scandals recently about in which certain police officers have been accused of manufacturing evidence, doing all sorts of things that railroaded people who turned out to be not guilty of the crime. How does a police department change that? I mean, if I were an ambitious detective, I would want to have a high success rate.
You change it by making it quite clear that at the leadership level that what you want is honesty in all things you do. In other words, that certainly as a police commissioner, you want arrests when appropriate. You want successful prosecutions, but under no circumstances should it be done in violation of the law. I have an expression I use all the time. You cannot break the law to enforce it. You cannot lower the threshold in terms of reasonable suspicion, probable cause. And indeed, that was some of the concern around the stop, question, and frisk issue, that the threshold for reasonable suspicion was being lowered or was not being used at all. And in the more egregious issues of somebody being sentenced to prison, being sentenced to life in prison because of falsification of testimony, that is the ultimate violation of the trust that is placed in the police to do everything we do lawfully. And you start at the top with enforcing that, and then you insist on it being followed all up and down the chain of command.
The behavior of drivers in the city has gotten a lot of attention recently, especially after several instances of drivers killing children. Mayor de Blasio has promised to crack down on bad and dangerous driving, but has that been an area where cops have been a little more tolerant than in some other parts? I mean, the stop and frisk on the one hand, but you do see people going through red lights all the time and nobody really is stopping.
There is. I basically don't agree with that at all. If you look at the statistics, summons activity, the success, if you will, of Vision Zero, the mayor's initiative to reduce pedestrian and traffic fatalities, we're seeing significant reductions in both of those categories. We're seeing significant reductions in the number of collisions. So the idea you control behavior to such an extent you change it. He just got approval for 120 more speed cameras in the city, which is a great thing.
Well, because past reports from the New York City government showed that cops ticketed people far less often for failing to yield to pedestrians than for failing to wear seatbelts.
That's correct, and that's one of the areas where you would basically focus the behavior of the police on an identified issue. So, in other words, where are pedestrians most likely to be struck? One, basically vehicles making right turns into intersections, or two, on the straightaways where speed is involved. So that's where you focus the police enforcement action. Seatbelts is another area of constant concentration because the injuries that are caused by collisions without seatbelts can be phenomenally significant.
Well, I live on a street where there's a sign that says no truck through traffic unless you're delivering something, and there are speed bumps. That hasn't stopped trucks from speeding down and along with the cars. They just hit those bumps and go flying, and they keep on going.
Well, the idea is the police cannot be everywhere, and that's where the effort is made to change the behavior so that we don't have to be everywhere. That's why I'm supportive of the camera systems, because they literally do the work of what a police officer cannot do, because we can't be there all the time.
One of the programs that you've said you'll change is Operation Impact. What's Operation Impact?
Operation Impact was actually a two-pronged program. One, it's the use of recruits fresh out of the academy to go into high-crime areas that I looked at and identified a couple of times a year. It was believed that that program did help to reduce crime significantly in those neighborhoods, but it also generated the unintended consequence of the stop, question, and frisk controversy. My own belief is you don't want to put your most recently trained, inexperienced officers into the most dangerous neighborhoods, which unfortunately are largely minority neighborhoods, and the resultant impact is to create tension. Does it reduce crime? Probably has an impact on that.
And what was the thinking behind putting the least experienced officers into the most areas that needed the most experienced officers?
A direct result of the force being reduced by 6,000 officers that Commissioner Kelly And his leadership team came up with a good idea whose implementation, I think, ended up being flawed because of the use of these young kids. We're going to attempt to change that going forward. But Operation Impact also had a second element to it, and that's overtime. To make up for those 6,000 officers being lost, the city funded significant amounts of overtime that allowed the police department to put out daily thousands of officers on overtime assignments in those same high-crime neighborhoods.
Eugene O'Donnell, an ex-cop and professor at John Jay College, has argued that cops may be relying on overtime pay in lieu of a raise. Could that raise a problem of corruption if cops seek ways to claim overtime simply to increase their income?
That could, and it's something that we're constantly mindful of. We recently had the unfortunate circumstance of two of my detectives on duty, spending their whole tour duty, one of them on overtime, in a bar, apparently drinking for 6 hours instead of being out investigating cases. So you have to watch for that type of abuse, put systems in place to catch it. And the idea of overtime being used to supplement overtime is always of concern, and you watch for certain practices that would lead to that type of activity and certainly look to prohibit them.
A lot of people are now concerned about federal and local excesses, even unconstitutionality and surveillance. The city is closing the division that had infiltrated and spied on Muslim and Arab groups. Did you have a role in that decision?
Oh, certainly. That although actually it really wasn't much of a decision to make, the unit, which at one time it was called the Demographics Unit, and it had a number of names during its history, at one time had as many as 16 officers. When I arrived, I think it was down to 3 officers or 4, and they were effectively not doing anything. That the unit had been downsized and redirected during my predecessor's time in office. So it was a pretty easy decision to make, that I have a lot of use for officers, and to have officers that were no longer performing an effective service, it was easy to basically do away with the unit.
A listener asks, what are you doing to make sure that legal political gatherings, non-Muslim, are not under surveillance? Because we've heard about that.
What needs to be understood is that under the guidelines we operate in, activity that occurs in public space that the police can, in fact, monitor, if you will, that we there oftentimes we provide crowd control, we provide traffic direction, street fairs. But the idea is there are limits to what we can be there for and what we can be doing there. And there's a need to do a better job of educating the public as to what both we at the local level and at the federal level, what can be done.
On the other hand, the city has spent an awful lot of, been forced to pay out an awful lot of money for some of the arrests it made during the Republican National Convention.
That's correct. I don't have much familiarity with that. I think I was in Los Angeles at that time during that event.
You mentioned earlier cyber warfare and cybersecurity. They're practically unheard of when you were here first. Now they're huge concerns. How is the NYPD addressing them?
Doing it very effectively, close collaboration with our federal colleagues. Thanks to our political leadership, Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, and others, that we are very well funded by federal homeland security initiatives, so that New York, being the number one terrorist target in the world, that needs to have the number one counterterrorism program in the world, and to defend against whether it's cybercrime, chemical attack, nuclear attack, traditional terrorist attack. And we're very fortunate that my predecessor during his time built up a very significant operation. I'll be seeking to build on that platform and make it even stronger by strengthening the collaborative relationships we have with our colleagues in the various federal agencies.
Since 1950, the city has had 9 mayors, but 21 police commissioners, counting Ray Kelly and yourself twice. On average, commissioners serve less than 4 years. Why do you think the commissioners have served so much less than the mayors who have appointed
it's
them?
It's the nature of the position. On average in America, a police chief serves 3 years. That is just high turnover, pressures of the job, the turnover of leadership and mayors changing, commissioners as they come and go. I'm an example of that. Most of my assignments have been 3 years, 4 years. Los Angeles was an exception, 7 years. Commissioner Kelly was certainly an exception of 12 years continuous service. That is very unusual in American policing.
There are some places where the police are actually, the police commissioners are elected, like Joe Arpaio.
Those would be actually sheriffs.
Sheriffs.
They serve
much of the same function in their areas.
And except that being an elected official creates a whole set of different tensions and pressures.
Well, have you ever thought of going into politics?
Not at all. Not in recent years. Looked at it very briefly in the late 1990s, and then I regained my sanity instantly and moved on.
And tonight you're going to be at the 92nd Street Y with David Gergen and Stanley McChrystal. Also, who's Dana?
Another general from the military.
Whatever his name is.
The behavioral sciences group. So it should be a very interesting forum this evening.
And thank you so much for being on our show.
It's great to be here with you as always.